Do you like movies? Then Netflix is the place for you. Would you like to support this podcast? Use the red stamp-shaped Netflix affiliate banner link in the show notes at truckertompodcast.com for a free trial and instantly begin streaming movies right to your computer or TV set-top box. Tango Tango Papa 1382, July 24, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Madison, Alabama. Spent the night last night there at McDonough, Georgia, and then slept until, I guess it was about noon or so, maybe one, and then it was noon Central Time. Got up. Went inside because I was parked in they had a parking area just outside their actual guardhouse, but it's on their property. So I went, checked in, and set about picking the load up. But it turned out I ended up waiting there for probably a good 3 hours or a little longer. Because, right after I first got there, it didn't take them long, and they said, okay, you can go ahead and hook on to the trailer, and as long as it's got a green light from the dock, go ahead and pull it out and get the paper that they put in the back there with the seal and bring that in to us. And so I did that, pulled the trailer out of the dock a little ways, got the paper and the seal. Then I went ahead and backed the trailer back into the dock because I couldn't really close the doors, because some docks are designed so that they leave enough space in between the, when the trailers are backed into the dock, they leave enough space so that you can actually open and close the doors right there. Other docks, they put the docks more narrowly together when they construct the place. As was the case at this particular warehouse, the docks were fairly close together. So, when I pulled it out, I couldn't, the only way I could close the doors would be to pull it all the way out to get it away from the trailer that was beside it. So I just backed it back in because it was a refrigerator. It was supposed to be 65 degrees. It's not really, really cold, but it keeps it cool. It's candy. And so I went ahead and backed it back up so that it wouldn't be exposed to the elements, and because it was pretty hot today there in Georgia. And so backed it back in, took the paper and the seal inside, and then somehow the woman in there, the clerk, discovered that they hadn't scanned something. And so she said, well, it's going to be a while because they're going to have to take the stuff back off of the trailer, because they failed to scan part of the, maybe part of the pallets or whatever. And so that turned out to be kind of a lengthy process of waiting, because I think basically what happened, they had to unload the trailer and then make sure they scanned everything, because they typically, in a warehouse like that, they'll use, they make lots of use of barcode scanners and barcodes. And, for their own purposes, inventory control purposes. So, and it eliminates errors and what have you. And so I, it wasn't that big of a deal. But in any case, that finally got out of there. I guess it was pushing five. It was about 5 o'clock Eastern time when I finally left there. And so in any case, I headed on up to the, Is that going to keep doing that? Hope not. Headed on up to the Atlanta area. There's a pilot on the south side of Atlanta. I filled the truck up, or the truck and the trailer up with fuel. Weighed the load. You know, it's kind of a fairly heavy load. After I filled the truck up, then I weighed it. And I think it was grossing right at 79,000. And it's kind of an odd, I had to slide the trailer tandems back quite a ways in order to get them legal, get the weights legal, because you're allowed, if you have an 80,000-pound truck, you're allowed 12,000 pounds on the steering axle, and then 34,000 on the truck tandems, and then 34,000 pounds on the trailer tandems, or no more than that. And so I had to, had to work to kind of get the weight distribution where it was, within the legal range. So finally got out of there, and then I got headed over here to Madison, Alabama. It turns out Madison, Alabama is it's along Interstate 65. It's sort of south of the, just south of the Decatur, Decatur, Alabama. It's kind of up in that, in the northern part of Alabama along Interstate 65. So, got here, and then initially what my Qualcomm says is that, you're supposed to unload between, you can get there between midnight and 4 a.m. And so I got there, it was about 10 minutes or so till midnight when I arrived there at that guard shack where this is going. It's a distribution center, and the woman looked in her computer and she said, well, you actually have a live unload at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. And so I, obviously that, if that's what's in her computer, that's what's in her computer. And she said, I asked her if we did very many drop and hooks there, trucking company. And she said, nope, hardly at all. Now, some of these distribution centers, they do a lot of drop and hooks, but apparently not at this particular one. So, there's, I'm at the exit, but on the other side, there's this street that it's kind of a dead-end street that goes into a FedEx place. You know, big wide street, kind of looks like it's been built for a sort of an industrial park type area that hasn't really fully been developed. And so they allow trucks apparently to park along the sides of this big wide street that has no traffic on it, hardly. You know, I guess FedEx would probably go up and down it, but I think it's closed. It's probably all closed up right now. So there hasn't been a car, any kind of car or truck that's come along. I've been parked here probably, I guess upwards of 2 hours at this point. So, in any case, she told me to come back at 6. So that's about, right now it's about 2:25 a.m. So I'll, drive back over there. It's probably, it's probably less than a mile back over there. It's just it's on the other side. There's this interstate highway. And, it's just basically on the other side of the exit from where I'm at. So, just have to cross back over and, go back over to that warehouse and, check back in with them. And then they should do a live unload. And so probably what I'm going to have to do is, basically sleep in the daytime. And that's kind of what I did, today, because I was up fairly late, last night, and so I set my alarm for so that it would wake me up at 1 Eastern time, 1 p.m. Eastern time this afternoon, and I woke up right before the alarm went off, which is what often happens. I'll often wake up before the alarm goes off, so. I don't know, it's kind of, for a long time I would, instead of using an alarm, what I would do, I would just kind of tell myself I want to wake up at such and such time. And it usually worked pretty well, but there were a few times where it didn't. But now normally, you know, I've gotten into the habit of using my own, I've got this old LG flip phone that I've had for, I don't know, more than 5 years. And, you know, it makes a great alarm clock. So I've gotten into the habit of using that. And there are times when, you know, I just don't want to take a chance that that I'm going to oversleep. So I'd rather, you know, just set the alarm and then I know that it's going to wake me up. And so that's what I do. Unless I don't, you know, it doesn't matter whether I wake up or not, then, you know, but I'll often still wake up, you know, just right before the alarm goes off. That happens quite a bit, but I'd rather have the be safe than sorry, in other words. So, by the way, I don't know, it's probably, I don't even know how long ago it's been, a few months ago when I fell out of the truck. And, you know, I kind of injured my left shoulder, and it was kind of giving me some problems. And I noticed the other day that it's not hurting nearly as, you know, because there for a long, the longest time, once I laid down to go to bed, you know, I'd start out laying flat on my back. And after a few minutes, it'd take 10, 15 minutes or longer, that shoulder would begin to hurt. And so I, you know, for years, I've gotten in, I was in the habit of sleeping on one side or the other, you know, on either on my left side or my right side. And so, you know, over the past few months, what has happened since I, you know, I couldn't, you know, lay flat on my back very long without that thing starting to hurt. And so if I laid on my side, one side or the other, it would still hurt. And so the only way that I could position it, I could really get myself in where it wouldn't hurt, would be to lay flat, you know, just lay flat on my stomach, you know, with my arms kind of, both arms kind of, you know, kind of basically sort of above my head, underneath the pillow. And so I've kind of gotten into the habit of doing that. And even, you know, now it's the thing I noticed that it now when I'm laying flat on my back, it really doesn't start to hurt. You know, that kind of quit. And I've also got, you know, the range of motion is pretty well back to normal. It's still, you know, still a little bit sore, but not bad at all. So it did get better or kind of all on its own, and I knew it would. It just, you know, you have any kind of a rotator cuff sort of injury, and that can just take a while for it to get, you know, to heal. And so it did. And so it turned out that my decision not to try to go to a doctor was actually a good one, because it got better all on its own. And, you know, all the doctor would have done would have been tried to, you know, they'd try to push a bunch of medicines off on me and you know, here's some exercises to do. Well, I've got exercises to do. I can do that myself. And so that, you know, in this case, it was a good decision not to try to go to the doctor, because it's pretty well back to normal at this point. So, you know, it did go back to normal, and it's really not giving me any trouble at this point. So, you know, just watch my step. I'm, you know, pretty careful, you know, climbing in and out of the truck. I'm pretty careful, because all it takes really is just one little misstep, and, you know, it can happen in just a split second, and before you know it, wham! Don't want to do that. That's dangerous. You know, so I'm, you know, I'm really, I've always, you know, I try to be careful. But all it takes is just one little, misplaced step, and you can be in big trouble. So I wrote an article a few days ago, and I talked about it in the podcast, about first three new media expos that they had in Ontario, California, starting in 2005. So you had the one in 2005, and then 2006, and 2007. And what a success those were from a social networking standpoint. And so that kind of got me to thinking about it, and I realized why. You know, what's the difference between, you know, I kind of talked around it as far as what happened in Ontario versus what happened in Las Vegas. In Ontario, you had perfect strangers kind of walking up to each other and introducing each other, and you had all these happy accidental meetings where people were just feeling free to strike up conversations. And that's not really unusual for podcasters. You put a whole group of podcasters together, what are they going to do? They're going to talk. But I realized that Ontario, that was a Ontario, California, just, you know, because of where that Ontario Convention Center is, of course, with the Marriott Hotel right across the big wide street, and then, you know, plus you had other hotels in the area, you know, next to the Ontario Airport, Ontario International Airport. You had, you know, it was just a relaxed atmosphere, and people felt free to talk. And, you know, and another thing, you really knew why you were there. You know, there wasn't any mystery. You know, there wasn't a bunch of other people that were kind of mixed in, except it's kind of funny that the very first New Media Expo that they had in 2005, In that Ontario Convention Center, which is a pretty big building and has a bunch of different rooms, they had this porta potty. A porta potty convention was going on in one of the adjacent halls. So, you know, that was that was kind of funny, but it didn't stop us podcasters, you know, from chatting it up and making all kinds of friends and what have you. So, Ontario was a great venue for, you know, people felt comfortable approaching strangers, perfect strangers, and striking up conversations. And that was true in 2005 at the first one, 2006, 2007. And then, of course, in 2008, the organizers moved it to Las Vegas. And gone was that atmosphere, you know, because it was Las Vegas. And even if you saw someone, you don't know, you were walking in the hotel or whatever, and you saw someone and you saw that they had a tag that they were going to the New Media Expo, Podcast New Media Expo, or whatever, they kept changing the name of it, but you could see their tag, you know, that they give you to get in and out. Of the convention, you know, in Las Vegas, you just don't, you know, it's a big city kind of feel, and you just don't feel, you know, and plus you got all those tourists around and what have you, and you just, it kind of kills the, you know, the, what you might do in, you know, what you do in Ontario, as far as approaching somebody, a stranger, and striking up conversation, it kills it in Las Vegas. It really kills it. And so that's one of the reasons why that it just wasn't that big of, you know, it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't Ontario, in other words. And that's one of the things that just dramatically changed it, because the atmosphere of Las Vegas is just, you know, different than the atmosphere in Ontario, you know, kind of a social atmosphere almost. And then that kind of got me to, so I wrote an article about this, I posted a second article about this, you know, I called it Location, Location, Location. And, you know, I kind of talked about this, you know, it was because it was a different atmosphere, and it really, in Las Vegas, it's just not conducive to people, you know, to strangers kind of walking up to each other and striking up conversations. So, and then that kind of got me to thinking, you know, because you hear, and that's why I named the article Location, 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 because that's the old business axiom, you know, what's, you know, the key to having a, really, if you're going to set up a, especially like a brick and mortar business, you need to have it in the right place. And so what is it about that? You know, because you can say, well, it's access. Got to have the right access. Well, it's more than that. Because your location sets, what does it do? It also, if you think about it, it sets a mood. So therefore, you know, if you're going to locate some sort of business somewhere, and you're looking for, especially if you're looking for sort of impulse buys, you know, and it, you know, it doesn't even really matter what you're selling. But if you're looking for the impulse buys, you've got to have the right location, and that location, if you really think about it, that location is going to get people into the mood to buy your product, whatever it is, your product or service. So, you know, and the same thing could be said for stuff on the, you know, if you're selling stuff on the internet, same difference. You know, you got to create the right atmosphere, and it's got to be in the right location. Right location, right atmosphere, in order to kind of put people into the right mood to buy your product or service, whatever it is you're peddling. And so, very important. But it goes beyond just a physical location. There's also a sort of a social aspect that, you know, it's kind of more difficult to put your finger on it, but it's obviously in the case, you know, it can be extremely important, you know, because just imagine, you know, just using the social networking example, you know, in what, you know, in a, some places you feel confident just walking up to somebody and striking up a conversation, but you know, if you're, let's say you're in Las Vegas with all those tourists and what have you coming and going, or you're, let's say you're in New York City, would you feel comfortable just walking up to a stranger and striking up a conversation? I don't think so. So it, you know, people won't even look each other in the eye, in some instances, because there's this weird psychological thing that goes on in big cities. So, you know, they're afraid that, oh, I can't make eye contact because they might ask me for something. You know, that's the, it's kind of weird, you know, and I know where that comes from. Because, you know, sometimes I'll have people walk up to me, you know, like, you know, people that are asking for money or people, you know, people that are wanting to see if you'll give them a ride somewhere in your truck. You know, which way are you going? I get that sometimes. I haven't gotten that a whole lot, excuse me, lately, but sometimes that happens. Or you have the people, the panhandlers, the hookers, and what have you. And it's easier. The psychology of it is, it's easier just to not make eye contact with them, you know. And there's certain, I don't know, usually there are certain, you can always kind of usually tell if somebody's coming up to ask for something like that versus somebody, you know, it's just a genuine, you know, like a driver that's, you know, has a question or something. You can all, you know, in the case of, you know, like at truck stops or other places, you can kind of tell if somebody is, you know, and it's not necessarily the way they're dressed, but it's kind of, there's something about the way they approach that tells you, hey, this guy's, you know, some sort of body language thing, I guess, more than anything. But there are times when, you know, you're walking along and you just don't want to look somebody in the eye because you're afraid they're going to ask you for something. And It's kind of a strange, kind of an interesting thing. You know, it's really interesting, you know, the psychology of that stuff. So, so I don't know. But as far as businesses go, it's more than just the physical location. It kind of depends on what your business is too. But it's more about, you know, there's really a lot goes, you know, what kind of mood does this put people into? And if it obviously a business that's put in a bad location, if somebody tries to open up a business that's just in the wrong location, then it destroys the mood to buy is destroyed. Even if, you know, and that's true, even if it's just a hard place to get in and out of, it, you know, that really destroys the mood, of, you know, of, obviously. So that's still mood related. So anyway, let me see here. I've got a couple of news stories and a little bit of email that's come in. So we'll start with this email. This is from email from Brent. Says, "Hey Tom, just a quick comment on the most recent podcast, Accents. You're mentioning you don't have an accent, at least to you. I'm here to say I think you do. I want to prove my point. Just say the word wash. You say it like a southern person, though normally you don't have any specific accent. I couldn't figure out where you were from. When I first started to listen, everyone to some extent has one. I have a Boston accent, and it's pointed out to me almost daily because I meet new people every day." Now, Brent is in Germany. "Americans from all over the country, first thing they say, 'You're from Boston, aren't you?' Great topics lately, very interesting. Many greetings from Germany," and that's from Brent. So, whoosh. So, do I... Because, you know, I may sometimes adopt, you know, I may say whoosh, you know, more like whoosh, W-A-R-S-H. But wash. So I guess somebody from Boston would say wash. I don't know. Or New Jersey. So I don't know. That's kind of interesting. I guess I'm biased. I can't really say it. You know, if I say the word wash, is that more like a southern style of saying it, or I don't know. Because it sounds perfectly Kansas to me. So anyway, thank you, Brent. And then this is Scott posted this on Facebook. Because I had the audio that I played, the iPhone thing, you know, where the... You know, that audio that I played in the last podcast, I posted those on both of those videos on Facebook as well. And so Scott made a comment on the one of them. It says, "Duh, gee, I just gotta love all my apps, ha 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 ha. I like my iPod Touch. It cost me less to buy than 1 month service to any of the other phones." Now, Scott was able to get a really great deal on his iPod Touch from Craigslist. "I use my track phone for the few calls I get or make for $7 a month. Ah, life is good. The only downside at all is not having Wi-Fi everywhere. I would hate that if I traveled for a living. Then I would have to say, I want an iPhone. LOL." So thank you, Scott. And then Ian had sent this link to this little short story about Netflix. "The company, which has roughly 14 million subscribers, has flourished south of the border." This is a Canadian story. "While rivals like Blockbuster have lost market share, Netflix's aggressive strategy includes providing streaming movies and TV shows via devices such as video gaming, consoles, and more. Recently, Apple's incorporated its iPad. Blockbuster, a once dominant U.S. video rental chain, operates over 450 stores across Canada, but does not offer an on-demand or home delivery rental service in Canada. It has been weighed down by over $900 million in total debt and struggling to avoid bankruptcy. And what this link was that Ian had sent, Netflix is going to bring streaming to Canada. They're going to, you know, be streaming movies in Canada. Currently, it's not Netflix's service is not available in Canada. It's only U.S. only. But they're going to be bringing, you know, the Netflix streaming to Canada. Now, I guess I'm not sure about the DVDs or Blu-rays, you know, if they're going to do a rental service or not. But, you know, they're going to have the streaming, and that's good. And then, let's see, Ian had sent another article, and this one's about buying and reselling your used electronics. There's some company called Gazelle. So Gazelle lands $12 million to buy and resell your used electronics. Gazelle, a company that buys and resells used consumer electronics, announced Wednesday that it has raised a third round of funding for $12 million. The new funding, bringing its total to $22 million, will be used to grow the business to meet consumer demand, build pricing models, and strengthen retail partnerships, according to the company's announcement. The company buys used consumer electronics such as phones, GPS units, laptops, game consoles, and camcorders from consumers and then resells them for slightly higher price on sites like eBay. While consumers could sell their own electronics, the process can be time-consuming and a sale is never a guarantee. Gazelle looks to become the middleman in the process and offer a price for the used electronics based on tracking and electronic market value. To make the process even easier, the company sends the consumer a shipping box and label to submit the electronic device. The company's retail partnerships are especially interesting, including a recent deal with Sears, where consumers can bring in their used electronics and receive a Sears gift card for the total amount of the gadget, according to Xconomy. Additional retail partners include Walmart.com, Sears, Kmart, Office Depot, and Costco. Disappointing, and this is the person that's writing this post here, disappointingly, my old LG VU phone was only going for about $26 with Gazelle, while on eBay the phone appears to be going for around $50. For the hands-off consumer strapped for time, Gazelle may be the route to take, but if one has the time and energy and values it at less than the cut Gazelle charges, one might generate a higher price for their old electronics. The Boston-based company, founded in 2008, previously secured a second round of funding for $6 million from Rockport Capital. Rockport also participated in this round, led by Physics Ventures, and with Venrock Associates participating. So that's kind of interesting. I have a whole house full of stuff I should send them. Let's see here. And then, not sure where this article came from. Oh, it was sent by Ian as well. Locast, it's L-O-K-A-S-T, shares media between iPhones and Android phones. Wireless IP networking company Nearverse has just rolled out an Android version of Locast mobile content sharing app. Locast is designed to help people within 300 feet of each other to share content, music, contact information, text documents easily between iPhones and now Android phones too, so now users can share content wirelessly across operating systems, i.e. from iPhones to Android devices. The new feature is a really big deal to Nearverse, according to co-founder CEO Boris Bogatin. Proximity means that there are any number of people inside our radius, and for most circumstances, that means different cell phones. If we were to limit our app to one platform, it would eliminate us from many situations, he explained. Nearverse is also taking advantage of the Android operating system's ability to have apps run in the background. Once started, Locast will run in the background and check to see if other Locast users are in the vicinity. If it detects other users, it will prompt them to share content, which does away with the problem of requiring that people turn on the app at the same time. And this makes for more serendipitous use cases. So far, music seems to be the type of content that has taken off with Locast. Artists, around 40 in all, are partnering with Nearverse over the summer, including Third Eye Blind and Echo and Bunnymen, are using Locast as a digital stage to share exclusive content at live performances. As far as Bogatin is concerned, music makes for a great showcase, but the company sees itself more as providing an experience based on proximity. Other scenarios it outlined include group collaboration in a class environment. Locast also lends itself to sharing trailers for movies, which is why movie companies are showing an interest, Bogatin said. While there are numerous apps designed for sharing content, Bump or for bumping contact information from one iPhone to another, Knocking Live for streaming video from iPhones to Android phones, Bogatin doesn't think the space is too crowded. When asked, he admits that such location-based services such as Foursquare, Gowalla, and others are sure to be interested in the proximity market and are going to make for competition. So I'm not really clear from this article what it does. Is it just automatically sharing? If, let's say, you have it running on your Android phone and someone else has an Android phone or an iPhone and they've got the app, the right version of the app running on their phone, does it just automatically share content, or you have to, it tells you, hey, there's somebody here that has something you want to share? Ask them, do you want to share? So I'm not quite... not quite sure on what's going on. Does it just push music across, or movie trailers? I don't know. That's not really clear. I'll have to check into that and see what that is really about. It just doesn't quite make any sense. It's kind of obscure. Anyway, I've got some more comments from Scott, and so I've got three more left. I'm just going to start going through these. So this first one is 4:49.
Okay, Tom, can you put this on your podcast? This is a note that is also going to be the name of a podcast, maybe, I don't know. I'm probably going to record a version of this for the podcast. But I wonder if you've ever heard of anything like this happening, because I was pretty amused at this the other day. As you know, I've been playing around with my iPod Touch, and it has Wi-Fi. It doesn't have internet via telephone. And so basically... I go places, over this July 4th weekend here, I've been going places and seeing where it'll work. So I was down at the park in Manchester when they had the fireworks, and there was tons of Wi-Fi down there. Depending on what part of Arnes Park I was in, there's a lot of, multi-story buildings with people living in them. So there's tons of Wi-Fi in those buildings. Some open, some not, but I was able to connect down there to some open Wi-Fis and do stuff, send text messages to my brother, as one of the things I did. And so anyway, it's fun sometimes to just watch the Wi-Fi nodes that come and go. If I was driving home from work one of the first days I had it, and I put it in the mode where it discovers, you know, Wi-Fi hotspots, and you see lists of the different hotspots that you have and whether they're locked or not. There'll be a little like lock symbol if it's secured. And the names people use are just infinitely, you know, variable. You know, from people, like one I went by, just kind of popped up unexpectedly, was, you know, cussing, you know, like F off, you know. and other ones like Jesus saves, you know, you just never know what you're going to see. And it's just kind of amusing to watch and see all the different Wi-Fi nodes that come and go as I head home and I go past, you know, regular residential houses and condominiums where there's lots of people. You see bunches of them pop up there, you know. Clusters of the Wi-Fi.
Let me interrupt. Just had a little idea pop into my head. I wonder if there's an app that you can install that will actually record a list of Wi-Fi nodes as you rove past them.
Nodes, and there's quite a few of them that are open. So, anyway. I thought it would be fun to do that on the highway, so I'm heading down yesterday. I wondered how fast these things would come and go, you know, because we're going to highway speeds heading to Maine. So, you know, we were still in New Hampshire. We hadn't gotten to Mass yet, and I'm watching these names come and go and come and go, and I'm kind of amusing myself with that. And I'd see different names come and go, but there was this one name that I saw, and it was there, and it just always seemed to be on the list. Now, the thing would refresh like once every 15 seconds or every 10 seconds, and so I noticed it was there, but you know, I'm assuming that these are like homes and things, but there was this one that didn't seem to come and go, and I didn't notice it at first because, you know, they don't come and go that fast, but they do come and go, and then I started, wait a minute, wasn't that there before? Wait a minute, wasn't that there before? So I started watching it, and I watched it for a while. And it mostly stayed there, you know, it did wink out, and then it came back, and it came back. And I'm saying, wait a minute, this can't be. I'm going by houses and stuff, and then it dawned on me, and I'm sure you knew what's happening. It was somebody in a car with their cell phone set to tethering, and it was, you know, Wi-Fi. It was Wi-Fi in a car. And it was open. And so I connected in to see, and I was able to connect in, and for 10 or 15 minutes, I was able to, you know, do the internet stuff. I didn't do that much. I wasn't, like, downloading and things like that, but, you know, I went on to my, instant message system and looked to see who was there and, you know, brought up the browser, things like that, brought up the Facebook application, and it's like, wow, this isn't working, you know, and then it went away, and it didn't come back, and it could have been whoever was in the car with that tethering, you know, took off on their exit, or we get too far from them, or whatever, but it was amusing, because I was literally tethering to tethering, you know, I was, and I don't know if you've ever done that, or heard of anybody doing that, but, that was pretty funny. So now, when I'm out there with this iPod Touch and I'm in the, you know, the passenger seat, you know, guess what I'm going to be looking for? Catch you later.
Okay, Scott, thank you. Now, I haven't, you know, I'm not, when I'm driving down the road, I'm not looking, you know, I haven't ever done that, you know, as far as trying to see you, because I do know that a lot of Wi-Fi nodes come and go. The Wi-Fi is everywhere. Now, what I have noticed is that, a lot of times if I'm parked in a, let's say in a truck stop or in a row of trucks, all kinds of weird Wi-Fi nodes may or may not pop up. And some of them, you know, I've seen, you know, it'll say like MiFi, which is, you know, there's this MiFi device basically that is an air card, but it's also a Wi-Fi node, Wi-Fi hotspot. So I've seen those before, and I never did. I don't know if I did. You know, I didn't even try to connect because I was using my own air card. But I did happen to see it. Now my phone functions. You know, I pay $30 extra per month to Sprint so that I can turn on and enable my own Wi-Fi hotspot. But in my case, I've got it secured. It shows up as Evo something or other, but I've got it secured so that not just anybody in the truck next to me can just attach to it. Because some people actually would. There are people that would try to. And then the other thing, you've got to be careful about having Wi-Fi turned on, because if you've got sharing turned on and you're in a public place, then you know what's going to happen. Like a motel, a lot of people don't think about that. They take their normal laptop with them to the motel, and they connect to the Wi-Fi, and then before and if you have your sharing turned on, because you obviously have it turned on at home, and you're connected at the motel, guess what you're doing? You're sharing your hard drive. And people can actually, attach to it and look at it, and maybe do some malicious things if they wanted to. there's been times where I've looked, I thought about that, and I looked, and I've seen other people's hard drives, the other shares that were available on a public network like that, in a motel. So, it's best to secure it, obviously. But I do see lots of, just different Wi-Fis, and sometimes they'll, the few times I've tried to connect to them, a lot of times there's no internet connectivity. Maybe it's just a computer, that's sharing something. I've seen a lot of weird, I don't know what, just different Wi-Fis, but a lot of them don't have connectivity. Now, if you see one that's named Linksys or Belkin, chances are, and it's open, those are usually people just have, they've plugged in the Wi-Fi, and there was no security by default, and they never did enable it. And so, usually if you see something like that, you're able to connect to it. But there, someone had either a MiFi device or their phone was a hotspot. Probably they had a MiFi device. Or, in the case of, the Apple machines, I can actually make, this MacBook, any Apple machine with OS X, that has internet connectivity. Let's say I've got my AirCard plugged into the Apple, into this MacBook. I can basically create my own Wi-Fi hotspot using the Wi-Fi that's built into the computer. And then other devices can connect to its internet source. And some people, you can do that on a Windows machine. It's not as easy, but you can do it. I've never, you got to go through a bunch of steps in order to try to enable that. So I've never, but with an Apple machine, it's very easy to do that. It's just one of the options in the Wi-Fi menu. But typically now, unless I'm connecting to Wi-Fi, like I'm going to connect to my phone, the hotspot, connect the computer to it, is the only time I have my Wi-Fi turned on. Most of the time, the Wi-Fi I just go ahead and turn it off. And then that way, it kind of cuts down on the power usage. The reason I do that primarily is because it cuts down on the power usage of the computer, making it less likely that the stupid DC to AC inverter is going to start screaming, hey, you're taking too much power. Like it was earlier. Now it's kind of quieted down. Got one more audio comment from Scott. I said I had three, but I think this one I played before. I played in the last podcast. So I think this is the last one. It's 2 minutes and 9 seconds. So here's Scott.
Okay, Tom, it's a podcast comment, and you were replying to me, making a comment about biased reporters. And you said your problem isn't that reporters are biased. Your problem is that they don't declare themselves. So would you please maybe outline what you think should be the law in this regard, or what you think every single reporter out there should do? If it's not a law thing and you just think that they ought to do it, how are they supposed to do it? And what if they change their mind later on and they realize that things they believed in were wrong? Do they have to continuously, you know, I changed my mind today, and where do they publish this? How do they get the word out?
Well, let me interrupt. I don't think that it should be a law. I think it should be an ethic. And the problem is, you know, it goes back to the society in general. As the moral fabric kind of decays, you know, and it's not ever going to be perfect, but as it decays, and in our case, ours started decaying in the 60s. And it's, you know, there's been this long slide since the 60s. And as the moral fabric decays generally, then you get all, you know, people don't, you know, the ethics aren't there anymore. You know, they're present in some people, but they're not present in others. And it becomes almost, you can think of it as a kind of a percentage thing. And so the more people that are unscrupulous and don't have any ethics and don't mind, you know, it doesn't really bother them to deceive people. They're, you know, it's easier for them to deceive people, and, you know, without any kind of conscience consequence, then they do it. And then, you know, in the case of the mainstream media, so-called mainstream media, they're all kind of, you know, they've got kind of got this thing going where they're all kind of part of the big clique, the big group, and they're all kind of reporting for each other because, you know, they're losing viewers like crazy. Even the the TV news, you know, they're losing viewers. You know, it's not just the newspapers that are losing subscribers and readers. And the magazines, the TVs, you know, the TV network, news TV networks are losing viewers. And so they're kind of reporting for each other. And so you've got this kind of externalized thing going on, where this externalized news culture, you know, where they're, you know, they don't really want to rock the boat too much and say something that their peers... their peers are going to, you know, criticize them for. They don't want to be criticized. They want those other people to think well of them. You know, I'm okay, you're okay. And so you can't, you can try to say, well, you know, you can have basic laws, you know, where they can't defame people. Now, I posted another article this evening. CNN, well, let me just pull up the article, and I'll just read the article that I wrote. I hadn't planned on doing this, but let me see if I can open it up. There it is. And I wrote this article, and I posted it on Geek News Central just before I started recording the podcast. Is CNN calling for curbs on free speech? On July 23rd, 2010... CNN anchors Kira Phillips and John Roberts discussed on air the idea that bloggers should somehow be held accountable for or perhaps regulated in some way. It's no secret that CNN and other so-called mainstream media outlets, both broadcast and print, have had for some time now an ongoing loss of viewers and readers. A number of traditional journalists from time to time have had and expressed an almost open hostility towards bloggers and the internet. They perceive the internet as a threat to their business models and their vaunted self-appointed job as information gatekeepers. If you look back over the past few years, almost every major story, particularly scandal stories, originated first on blogs. In many cases, the mainstream media were dragged kicking and screaming into reporting stories. The clearly forged National Guard documents that ultimately ended up forcing CBS to fire evening news anchor Dan Rather comes to mind from a few years ago. Bloggers quickly picked up on the fact that the supposed National Guard documents had been typed up in the default template for Microsoft Word and then ran through a fax machine a number of times to make the documents look dirty and or old. The trouble was, Microsoft Word didn't exist in 1973. If it weren't for bloggers, this story would have likely never come to public light, and what is clearly a forgery and a made-up story would have passed into the public mind as the truth. Should free speech be curbed? Should bloggers somehow be licensed or officially regulated in what is purportedly a free country? Should we be forced to get our news from quote-unquote professional or even quote-unquote licensed journalists? And so anyway, that was the article that I published this evening at geeknewscentral.com. So, but anyway, let's go ahead and listen to some more of Scott's comment here.
And most importantly, your implication was that this gal who said the Jews should just go home was worse than a lot of reporters out there. Well, who, you know, show me a reporter out there that doesn't pretend to be unbiased. Show me a newspaper out there that doesn't pretend to be unbiased. Show me a freaking website out there that doesn't pretend to be unbiased. Do you know of any right-wing websites that come right out and say, we're far right-wing?
Rush Limbaugh, for one.
You know, find me six of those. Show me any kind of a trend.
Breitbart.com, BigHollywood.com. I can find a bunch of them. There's a bunch of them that are, they come right out and they're making no bones about it that they're conservative, and I have no problem with that, you know. And what about and what's that one? The Huffington Post, you know, I think they pretty much, I don't know if they make the claim that they're left-wing, but that's, you know, all the left-wing people hang out there, and that you got all the left-wing posts, and left-wing, you know, news stories, sort of, you know, the left-wing take. So, you know, they're, and I'm sure there are some other left-wing websites. So there are plenty of websites that are sort of declaring what they are. But it's really a matter of ethics. And, you know, of course, ethics in our society have gone down the drain. Now, there's with that article that I posted on geeknewscentral.com a while ago, I also posted the link to the video segment where those two CNN anchors were sort of discussing the thing. You know, in their viewpoint, oh, well, it's bad, and, you know, stuff's getting posted, and people are being defamed, and what have you. And something's eventually going to have to be done, some kind of regulation or something, or, you know, whatever. But then, you know, they're not, what about, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. What about CBS when they smear somebody? Or what, you know, they've made up quotes that Rush Limbaugh said that, you know, they've just fabricated them, and he didn't say it at all, but they repeated it and repeated it and repeated it until after the story had done its damage, and then, oh, sorry, these were wrong. You know, that when he was going to buy the St. Louis, I think it was the St. Louis Rams, he was going to buy into a portion of that, and they basically, you know, fabricated the story. You know, he made these, you know, they fabricated these made up quotes that, and then they repeated it and repeated it and repeated it for about a week, and then it killed the deal, and he wasn't able to buy into it. So who's gonna, can they be prosecuted? So I believe that, you know, we could come up with some perhaps some better defamation laws, anti-defamation laws. I think Great Britain, I don't know now, maybe somebody from Great Britain that's really familiar with it can talk about it, but I'm not, you know, from what I understand, that, you know, defamation is taken much more seriously, and Great Britain's got some decent defamation laws where, you know, so that someone that's being defamed has a much better chance of actually, you know, kind of putting a stop to it. You know, at least if it's being published, you know, however it's being published. But really what it comes down to, you know, you can have laws, but people will just ignore them. You know, if you get really immoral people, who's going to pay attention to laws? You know, how many people in prison pay attention to laws? You know, you got a collection basically of, you know, in a prison population, you know, chances are you're going to have a higher percentage of immoral people. And, of course, they're, you know, immoral people are, you know, they're going to not pay attention to the laws. They're going to break the laws, of course. So the solution is to get people to be moral. And that's tough. That's a tough thing. And, but that's really what has to happen, because otherwise you're just going to end up with a group of immoral people, you know, and you have to put them in some sort of prison, you know, turn the country into a giant prison, which it's being turned into anyway, turn it into a giant prison, and then, you know, put cameras everywhere, cameras and microphones, and that's what's happening. So, you know, I don't think that there should be laws against defamation. And but people should be really face scorn if they tell lies about people, you know, other people. So it's, but as far as reporters, there are some really blatant things that have gone on. You know, this Dan Rather thing from a few years ago, you know, with the fake documents, that was just egregious. And what happened to Dan Rather? He you know, CBS, and it was only because of blogs that we found out about it, and then it became a story, because otherwise they were just going to, at first Dan Rather said, oh, well, these are legitimate documents. And then when it was proved, it was just Microsoft Word. You know, because when I first saw that, I saw the document, a graphic of the document. And so I opened up my own copy of Microsoft Word and actually typed it in there, typed those words in there in the default template for Microsoft Word, and it, perfect match. You know, how stupid were these people? You know, how stupid is Dan Rather? You know, but that's a case where, you know, it was just total defamation and wrong, you know, complete lie. You know, he lost his job, but then, of course, they ended up, all of his news buddies ended up giving him some kind of an award, you know, after that. And, of course, you know, so, but there's plenty of examples where the mainstream media has defamed people. And, you know, and a lot of it is just kind of based on, it's not really, some of it might be accidental, maybe a small percentage of it. But a lot of it is politically motivated. And so what we really have to do, if we really want to correct the problem, is improve our morals. That's really the only solution, because otherwise we're going to end up in a prison system, basically, and, or, you know, with some kind of dictator running it.
Trend towards honesty. I doubt you could do that. Find me 6 people that have declared, or even 6 websites that have declared, and that's a pretty low burden of proof, you know, just saying websites. There aren't a lot of websites out there that are pushing news that don't claim to be unbiased and all that. They all want to be, you know, they all want to be considered to be unbiased, because who wants to be considered a biased reporter? Yes, and that's my comment on that. I think that is just the nature of the beast of reporting. You pretend to be unbiased, but you're not. They're all biased.
No, I disagree. Now, maybe the websites you're looking at, there are quite a few, obviously, that try to pretend to be unbiased. And certainly the mainstream news, you know, more recently, they're not even, they don't even try to pretend like they're being unbiased. The mainstream, they become more shrill. And it's kind of interesting, is the more shrill they become, the more viewers they lose. But there are plenty of websites, that are doing, kind of gathering different stories and actually reporting things. And they're not trying to pretend. They're just coming right out and saying, we're conservative, and we're proud of it. How do you like that? So it does exist. You just have to look for it. And, so that they are out there. But it goes back again. I mean, if it really does go back to, you can have laws and what have you, but you really have to have the ethics. Those ethics have to be there. And how do you get that to happen? Well, it starts with, in the family, and if you really what's caused our moral decline is the breakup of the family. That's really where the biggest problem originates from, is the breakup of the family that's really started happening in earnest in the 60s and continues through this day, and it threatens the very existence of our society. Anyhow, probably better be cutting this off. We're at almost 67 minutes. So I still have, what time is it, 3:24, so I've still got roughly 2.5 hours before I can go back over to that warehouse, and hopefully they'll let me in, and then I can get in there and get out and find some place to park and sleep. Anyhow, hope everyone has a great weekend. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.